Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome back to the second part of this program, which will feature regular presenter Nicholas Mulroy and guest Thomas Guthrie. I'm Robert Hollingworth, and as this goes to press, I'm just back from the BBC Singers Late Night Prom in the Albert Hall. It was a wonderful advertisement for what choral concerts could become, in some instances, with the right attitude to programming and, importantly, core funding to back it up. But that is generally not how we run professional vocal groups in this country. If you're listening in France or Germany, you'll find that very odd. There were three pieces: Joanna Marsh's Scene for Voices and Live Sound Manipulation by Glenn Scott, so 2023 technology, great. I love this piece that referenced lost or silenced female voices and asked the question, who gets to tell my story? I wonder whether there's a potential visual aspect to this piece as well. Commission that, anyone? Then there was my favourite piece of 20th century choral music, Daniel Lesur's Song of Songs, Le Cantique des Cantiques, 20 minutes of rich, mid-20th century French writing for 12 voice parts. Its text is apparently sensual poetry, but from the Old Testament book of the Song of Songs. Daniel Lesur's son says that he thinks his father would have enjoyed the ambivalence of whether this is religious or not. I'm reminded there's a whole Choral Chihuahua ep on this piece with Eamon and me. Then finally, we had a brilliant piece by Sumik Datta called Awaz, referencing 75 years of partition of Pakistan from India. Like The Marsh, it was previously commissioned by the BBC Singers and premiered last year. Remember, you only get to put out fantastic pieces like these in the proms if you take the risk and commission the music in the first place. Great that they were getting further performances. I thoroughly encourage you to go to the BBC website and listen to the whole piece. But here's the end, with Aref Durvesh and Pratap Ramachandra vocalising as well as playing along with composer Sumik Datta on his sarod, and the BBC Singers very evidently having the time of their life. You can tell, because if the basses are bopping, then everyone is. Sensational. whole concert conducted by the BBC singer's chief conductor, Sophie Genin, though in that piece she was absolutely allowing the players to lead on rhythm. While we're praising the BBC singers to the skies, let's also remember that they have a 50-50 gender policy on composers they perform to. In the audience, it was nice to bump into fellow singers. I spotted singers from Stile Antico, Swan Consort, Epiphany Consort, X-King Singers, Marian Consort, the laryngologist Declan Costello was there. Several composers, apart from Joanna Marsh, whose music was featured, there were a large number of people from, I'm guessing, an Indian ethnic background, perhaps come to enjoy the wonderful piece Awaz, or maybe because they just love Daniel Azu, I don't know. I'm just mentioning all this because the BBC Singers was due to have been entirely axed before the proms happened this year. I don't know what the news is here about what sort of reprieve they're on. Obviously, still a worry for the singers. If anyone wants to come on from the BBC Singers management and update us, that would be great. When I posted about this concert, one professional singer replied and pointed out that for the rest of us in the UK, without core funding, it's getting fairly desperate and becoming almost impossible to run professional vocal groups and to be a professional freelancing in the way that we have for years. Promoters seem largely to have less money, travel is less and less reliable, and of course everything else is going up in price. So of course we set up supporters groups, which listeners like you surely know about and help out with. Thank you. Sine qua non. Anyway, let's get on with the main interview. Robert Quinney, Director of Music at New College Oxford, where Eamon and I studied at different times in the dim and dusty past. And after that, Tom Guthrie is there with Nicholas, continuing the sense of our previous chat, before we all too briefly join Eamon with young singer Ellie Stamp.
Dottore, dottore. Robert.
Nice to see you. How are you?
That's the official Robert Roberts.
It is.
Introduction.
Robert. Fiat Panda, the car built by Roberts. Did you see that?
Not the local news, 1984 or something.
Fantastic. Pass us down a bob. What would you like?
I'd like a cortado, please.
Interrupted cadence.
So now sitting with Robert on the top floor of Gatehouse Coffee with its frankly unparalleled view of the York Ring Road system.
And Jenny's Fish and Chips. It's fantastic.
Jenny's Fish and Chips. Ex-York graduates will know immediately where that is, and the police as well. Welcome to York. This programme needs to start with an apology because I thought you were doing a lunchtime recital today, so failed to realise that you performed the whole of Vaughan Williams' Fifth Symphony last night in your own arrangement.
I did. Yes, I gave a recital at the Minster yesterday evening, and it's the first time in my career that I've actually solicited a recital. But some years ago I started arranging the Fifth Symphony of Vaughan Williams, which I've loved since I heard it as a teenager. And I thought it'll work pretty well on the organ. So I arranged the third movement and played that quite a bit and started work on the rest of it. And then, like everything, usually in every aspect of my life, it was left unfinished. Until Ben Nicholas, my colleague at Merton, said, could you come and play your Vaughan Williams arrangement? Meaning just the third movement. They were having a little Vaughan Williams festival last year. And I said, well, why don't I try and do the whole thing? So I'm in quite a hurry, and I was on sabbatical that term, so I had time, finished it off, played it at Merton. Then I thought, well, that was lovely, but what it really needs is a symphonic organ. And where would be a good place to play it? And can I actually bear to solicit a recital? Because it's desperately uncool to write to somebody and say, please can I give a recital? But I did. I wrote to Robert Sharp at York Minster, having heard wonderful things about the restored organ. And he very kindly took me up on the offer, amazingly. So it was just a tremendous pleasure. But York Minster means a huge amount to me because I sang a week of services there as a 12-year-old.
When you were at Dundee?
Well, in fact, it was after that. So we'd moved from Dundee to Sheffield. I had sung in Dundee Cathedral Choir for a couple of years. But that was one of those choirs that does, I think it was Sunday mornings and maybe Sunday evensong and a couple of rehearsals in the week. We moved to Sheffield and I didn't sing in the cathedral there, which would have been a similar experience. I sang in a parish church choir. But the Royal School of Church Music operated a Northern Cathedral Singers, which was made up of loads and loads, all boys of course, loads of kids from parish churches around the north of England. There was a southern equivalent as well. conducted by a man called John Cook, who was sort of godlike to me. And there were these residential courses, 1988, when I was 12, in York, and the following year in Ripon. And the experience of coming into the Minster every day and singing Evensong, preparing that music, and that very quick turnover, the kind of smash and grab of the choral tradition as it's articulated in these choral foundations. The 12-year-old me thought, I want to do this. This is what I, you know, and so really that set me on the path that I'm clinging to.
Is there an issue with something like that in that you're the one person who can't really hear it in the building because you're there at the console?
Yes, and there's a slight cognitive, I suppose, dissonance to it, because, and especially for the audience as well, because there is the organ up on the screen, and then the console.
So just for those not familiar with cathedrals, you mean the rude screen built.
Yes, indeed. What's the pulpitum is the technical term, isn't it? So the great big stone thing that divides the two major bits of the cathedral, nave from choir. And it is huge and monumental at York. And so there is this very imposing organ in a case and sort of spread around as well, up on that screen, on that stone screen. Then the audience sits in the nave, the main sort of huge space, facing it, and in between the audience and the organ is the console. So what they see is me operating this thing, this console, keyboards and, you know, the pedals.
Because the console is movable.
It's movable for recital, so you can see. It's quite nice, I suppose, for the audience to see
your back.
The back.
Always eye in the back of your shirt.
Yeah, right, absolutely. And then they hear the sound coming from beyond me to them. It's slightly odd, but in the great space of a building like the Minster, I mean, it sort of comes out in the wash, so to speak. I think they quickly become accustomed to it. And for the player, the sound is sort of slightly being thrown over one's head toward the audience. So a technique that I picked up from the great organist Olivier Latry, he gave a recital at Westminster Abbey when I worked there, and I was astonished by his use of the organ. It's an organ I knew very well. I played it every day. I played Messiaen's La Nativité.
Wow.
And it's just sounded fantastic, and there were combinations of stops that I couldn't work out. I couldn't work out what they were, so I asked him afterwards. And he said he does a lot of listening, just to individual notes played on one stop against another stop, and then he listens in the echo to hear how they're going to blend, and he can sort of extrapolate from that how it's all going to work, because organs are often spread around over quite a large area of a building, so you can start to intuit a sense, I suppose, of how it's going to be.
Have some more cinnamon roll. How is the cinnamon roll?
Oh, very good, thank you.
And on we talked, but at this stage we should have some music. I got to choose one piece and he got to choose the other, and it turned out to be a Magnificat and a Nunc Dimittis, though from different settings. So here we go with mine. I was going to have just part of the New College Service, which isn't one of Howells's most well-known Mag and Nuncs. But I have to say, I hadn't sung it or heard it since I last sang it in 1988 or something. And as soon as I put it on, I just couldn't stop it. I hope you'll forgive me for this. Robert writes in the programme notes about this that the New College Service is Howells at his sunniest and most straightforward. The chapel's dry acoustic does not allow for the ethereal atmosphere of the Gloucester or slow burn grandeur of the St Paul's service. But I have to say, love it, I do. And I had my hands in the air, gesticulating wildly at some of the big phrases for basses. Marvellous. This was recorded just last summer in New College Chapel, with Robert conducting the choir of New College and Donald McCann on the organ.
Thank you. You're beginning your 10th year. Where the heck did that... I mean, you succeeded Edwin Higginbottom, so Eamon and I, who normally present, were students of his, and we feel he just left a couple of years ago. But this is your 10th year.
Yes, yeah, remarkable. I think that's probably a reflection of the fact that Edward did 37. So, you know, until I've done at least half of that, I suppose it will seem like I've only been there 5 minutes. But yeah, I'm about to start my 10th year.
And what's the workload for the singers? Because I remember one of my reasons for choosing to apply to New College was that it was different from Christchurch and Magdalen, different hours, a little bit shorter, giving us a little bit more time to do our own thing. Is that still the case?
It is, and the crucial difference is that unlike the other two choral foundations, the junior choral foundations, because they're younger than New College...
Naughty smile as you said that.
Yeah, unlike those two wonderful places, we don't sing on a Sunday morning. So that can mean lie-in, or it can mean sport, or it can mean singing elsewhere. So even I actually quite often am to be seen playing the organ or directing the choir somewhere else on a Sunday morning.
But there isn't that crossover. It was always said that James Bowman, of very blessed memory, used to sing at New College and then rush across to Christchurch to get an evensong there the same afternoon.
I think he did. It might be like it used to be at King's and St John's when I was a student in Cambridge, that certain very keen punters would come to evensong at King's at 5:30 and then race down Trinity Street to catch St John's at, I think, 6:15.
We know who those people are. Yeah. Now, you have female alters at the moment. Ellie Stamp, formerly of this parish, is currently one of your back row. How does that work on the front row for Thoughts for the Future? Any sense of change there? Because obviously it's very flexible at the moment.
Yes, it's a kind of fluid situation, and we don't have any plans to change because all of our choristers are at New College School, and New College School is an all-boys school, as indeed are the two other schools attached to the choral foundations in Oxford. What's changed, in fact, since I arrived nearly 10 years ago in Oxford, is that opportunities for girls have arrived where there were very few before. There was the Oxford Girls Choir, but that's a secular choir. Now, the cathedral has a set of girl choristers, Frideswide Voices, mm-hmm. in which my younger daughter sings, and my elder daughter was a founder member of that. And for a time, they were sort of peripatetic and moved between the three foundations. So they did, I think, Christchurch in Michaelmas, New College in Hillary, which is the term that starts in January. And
yeah, these names refer to terms. Michaelmas is the autumn term, and yeah. Hillary is the spring term. You just have to have a different name for it.
Yeah, we need a glossary. So, yes, they moved around Christchurch, New College and Magdalen, and then Christchurch have actually subsumed them within their foundation. The difference is that those girls, and indeed also the excellent girl choristers at Merson, are singing one service a week and not doing the full panoply of things. If parents wished for their daughter to sing a daily service, then the opportunities are limited to places that board, actually, I think, now, with Windsor and with, where else, St John's now.
Which is a different financial question entirely. Thing, yeah. Well, let's watch this space. Everything's changed so much in 30 years, and I'm sure it will continue to. This is just a short interview, but tell us about a piece of music that you absolutely love that we could play now and choose a recording as well.
This piece is the Nunc Dimittis from a set of canticles that we commissioned from Deborah Pritchard a few years ago. The process by which we arrived at this piece that we just recorded last year was not a completely straightforward one, in that Deborah revised quite a bit. It's rather wonderful to have a composer so involved with us. She came more than once simply to hear the choir sing evensong, to get a sense of the space. Mm-hmm. And the way that we sing.
Because New College is not your typical Gothic large building. It's quite a dry building. I remember doing a lot of... I'm enjoying this cinnamon roll. Quite a lot of... Well, a huge amount of Baroque music there with Edward. And whereas in some buildings that would just get lost, you could really do the detail in New College.
Yeah, absolutely. And indeed, we still do that. I mean, we sing a cantata every... Bach cantata every term. We tend to sing a Passion every year. We do half the Christmas oratorio alternate years. And it's a good building for that space, and actually rather nice to do that music with the choir in the stalls, the instruments between, in camera, sort of. Anyway, Deborah did come and really listened, I think, to how we do things and thought carefully about how she wanted the piece to sound. And then, indeed, having had the first performance of it, she revised quite a bit and, in fact, simplified it.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've ended up with is this Nunc Dimittis, which is largely composed of canons between pairs of voices.
Mm.
And like canonic music, you think of the glorious canons of Talis and Bird in the 16th century, where, you know, different voices have the same music but at a temporal difference. There is a hypnotic kind of cyclic effect about mm-hmm. it. Timeless, you might say.
Josquin, King. Agnus Dei from the Sextetoni Mass. Oh, yes.
Yeah. It really evokes a sense of space and time.
And peace, I suppose.
Yeah, and is also very grateful to sing. These are beautiful lines, and singing in canon is also, you know, a wonderful experience to hear what you're doing somewhere else, as if it's an echo, but it's continuing, and you're being drawn along this kind of track by the other voices.
That's an interesting polyphonic point, isn't it, in that I still maintain that if you're an audience, you like hearing homophonic music mostly, because as a singer, you like seeing polyphonic music because you feel the movement against other parts. It's like being in a sort of someone's Medusa hairnet. You can feel this stuff moving around you, and you know it's the same material, just slightly inflected. But it's quite a difficult thing to listen to, polyphony.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's true of more recent music as well. I often think the music of Kenneth Layton, which is fabulous to perform, so involving, it's quite a hard listen, you know, and it's gritty and tough. Rather astringent music, though he's so skilled, and he's I don't know whether you must know that fabulous Manly Hopkins setting,
God's Grandeur, which we've been singing a lot. That was Brian Johnston cake in mouth moment there. Yeah, we did it in our T.S. Eliot program, Rewilding the Wayside.
Oh,
I mean, I think that is a work of absolute sublime magnificence. I was trying not to say genius here, but I was just, when you said that, I thought, gosh, that's not my experience of Layton. You know, if you like fourths, you'll love Layton.
But he deploys homophony, all the voices sounding together, singing this text right at the end. I mean, that kind of coup de grace at the end because the Holy Ghost.
Mm.
Goodness me. Mm. I mean, you know, goosebumps just thinking about it.
Lovely moment at the end of God's Grandeur by Kenneth Layton, which was the starting point for a Joanna Marsh piece written for Fagellini that we're going to record this year. She took the last line of that and set an Irish poem, The World is Charged, which isn't the same poem. It's inspired by the...
No.
Anyway, one for another story.
And Joe wrote us a wonderful piece a few years ago, Inni Spiritus, which mm-hmm. is on a text of Hildegard. We have just taken around the States to great... I mean, the audience has absolutely loved it. Wonderful, kind of...
I think she's the real thing, isn't
yeah,
she?
Fantastic.
Anyway, the Nunc Dimittis. This could have been much longer, but at least it was longer than the Martha McLaurin in her car episode. Safe journeys back to Oxford. We'll try to send you the odd other good singer down from York.
Well, thanks for Ellie. She's been an absolutely wonderful addition to the choir this year. Mm. So this is New College Choir, recorded last year on the hottest day on record, where New College Chapel was the best place to be, because it actually doesn't get much direct sunlight, so it's pretty cool, singing Deborah Pritchard's Nunc Dimittis from her New College service.
the Nunc Dimittis from Deborah Pritchard's New College Service. From that new album on Lynn Records, New College Commissions and Premieres, just recorded just a year ago. And as so often, the microphone goes off and we have as interesting a conversation off mic as we did on. But there was one other little thought or a little story he recounted, which I thought would resonate with people. Here it is.
With the children, and I've seen this with all the children I've worked with in my career. I remember very particularly when I was very briefly director of music at Peterborough Cathedral before I came to New College. Anyway, we did a performance of the Matthew Passion with the Peterborough Choral Society, and the choristers of the cathedral were being drafted in, and I thought, well, we don't have much time on this. They can sing the ripieno in the first movement and the chorales, and if we've got a bit of time, we'll look at the other choruses. But they probably won't sing very many of them. And I made up vocal scores for them, wrote in the translation. We were singing in German, and we just would look at it, get the senior boys and girls together once or twice a week, and over the course of one term, they learnt the whole piece. And they absolutely wouldn't not learn it because they found the music so incredibly compelling. And so there's a kind of inbuilt, you know, externally it looks like ambition, but it's not really that. It's just a kind of internal drive to know this music, to kind of have it. And I think that works on kind of every level with singers.
Well, Robert Quinney there. And isn't that just... That's just so true of all the creative arts, isn't it? You know, dance, an actor or a painter, they'd surely recognise that need to understand art and to participate in it. I mean, that's why your music and theatre charity exists, Tom.
Yeah, and being creative. And I think that that's, you know, I think actually what Music Theatre for All is about is sort of challenging the notion of elite art in the sense, in a very conceptual way. In the sense that it's all storytelling is in some way community, and necessarily any storytelling of quality needs to be embedded in that. And we've again this 20th century sort of traditions that have and talking about singing, I'm just about to with the Alehouse Boys to release this Schubert song cycle. It's coming out soon. Again, taking the opportunity to challenge, to put this attitude of putting the audience first, of relaxed situations, not just to break it down or to dumb it down in any way, but to actually say this is what the true quality, where the true quality is. So to say that you have to go somewhere elite and expensive or unwelcoming in any way to ordinary people is counter to absolute genuine quality, I think, and that's what the charity is really about. And I find myself talking quite a lot about that because it's a fight for funders. It's a fight in every way to say that, and actually, I'll finish that sentence, to say that outreach outreach is even a thing. Outreach, I mean, what does it even mean? And there was a wonderful article by Lynn Gardner, who writes in The Stage a lot, and The Guardian always writes fantastic stuff about this sort of thing, about where quality is. Actually, Richard Morrison, we've already mentioned, did in a recent article as well, talked about some of the best art is in the community, is local. And there, for me, there's a real reason for that. It's about quality, about genuine quality. Some of my favorite experiences have been free, and very invented sort of theatre, very low budget, essentially with music, because there's so much skill required to achieve the absolute highest level, and discipline and dedication and so on. So it's not quite the same, I think, although theatre, again, is an incredibly craftful business. There we go. Sorry, I'm dragging on far too long with that. But no, yeah, music and theatre for all, yeah, for everybody, and finding ways for people to be creative, because it's so good for people. And once you get people's voices into the room, you can find quality. You can find the best kind of engagement, the stuff I want to listen to all the time.
This takes us back to the beginning of the program in a way, in that, you know, what is it that gets the best out of people? And creating something yourself, you make investment then into the process, as opposed just to be told what to do. And I was at a friend's house recently reading a book about, maybe it was just the preface in the first chapter about good management, and they were making the point that the top-down model doesn't work, but nor does the bottom-up. And actually, the best organizations are cells of individual creativity, people working in small teams where each of them are invested.
that's harder to do, but it's also much, much harder to break. I think the big problem with all this is that, and why your talk about outreach is so difficult, is because for years now, decades now in the UK, our state music education funding has just been withdrawn. And we all know this, but you can have all the charity projects you like in the country, but they won't replace exposing everyone to music at school. You know, if there's a charity thing that you go to and you have the chance to take your child to, that's great. But at school, everyone did it. When I was at school, I was at a state school, everyone played an instrument, violin, recorder, or whatever. Everyone did something.
Mm. That's exactly right. And we in schools, we place so much priority, if that's the right word, on physical education, on kids getting active and doing swimming and running and playing team sport, collaborating, which is right. That's not to say at all. But something like music does all those things for the mind, doesn't it? The collaboration, the individual creativity, reacting in the moment, all those things are hugely valuable. And this argument that that music is, you know, improves other scores, you know, improves people's performance in maths and English, that's great, fine, but it's also learning music at that early stage connects us to a stream of creativity that lasts, you know, the duration of the human race, and feels much more valuable than just, you know, I also got better marks in maths.
It's very strange that, you know, physical education is seen as part of a child's upbringing for obvious reasons that we all get, but that mental development and the mental health benefits that involvement in the arts bring is somehow treated as an extra. I don't really see, is it because sports bring in more money? I can't believe that's actually the case. Well, maybe it is, I don't know. But I mean, look, a quick shout out to all those who still do teach music in schools, respect to you, and for those who work in the many organisations around the country who are flying the flag.
Yes, and also just sort of very quickly, Robert, but artistic institutions, I still work very closely with the Royal Opera House Learning Participation, and they're doing a lot of teacher training in creativity in teaching. So even if you don't teach music, but you teach maths or science in a creative way, you know, I think there's some fantastic work going on in that sense.
Yeah, there are fabulous things that I know the Aurora Orchestra have created basically a syllabus that you can just take for a school class project, so non-specialist teachers can teach music. And just finally, I don't know if this is the right sort of thing, but presumably all of us have a moment when we heard a piece of music and can remember hearing that piece of music and it in some sort of way changing our lives. Do you guys want to talk about that?
Theme tune to Bod. I was four.
Yeah. Here comes Bod.
Here comes Bod.
Tom?
Yeah, I can't for Tom, that's going to sound so. there's lots. I mean, there's stuff, you know, the old desert island disc things is always interesting, isn't it? What you take. I haven't got a quick answer for what really influenced me. My sister and I had a huge competition about, we were going to be competitive about Mozart, but which was our favourite. And so we listened obsessively just to be incredibly competitive. The Mozart 40th Symphony was the one I did. And I used to make up stories to it. Yeah. So,
yeah. Sorry, oh, the trouble with all this. Oh, actually, Sammy, have you got one?
Yeah. No.
Thank you. I should have said that.
Yeah, it's like being on tour with you when you're doing lists and you ask your five favourite this, that and the other. I'm not sure I've ever seen yours. The trouble with all this is that we are quite literally preaching to the choir. So let's move on to a final super short interview. Robert Quinney mentioned a young singer just out of the department here in York who's been singing at New College this year, Ellie Stamp. And quite by chance, Eamon Dugan of this parish was working with her at Rydale Festival in North Yorkshire on an opera project over the summer, Blow's Venus and Adonis. And he spent a few minutes with her. I have to say, we normally edit out the glitches and restarts in this sort of piece. But going back to where we started, the particular energy and adrenaline that happens when you just come off stage in a stage performance, as these two had both come off stage, they were slightly adrenaline full. I thought it was funnier to leave the whole thing as it arrived from Eamon.
So I'm here with Ellie Stamp. We're in Malton in Yorkshire. We've just finished the third show of Blow's Venus and Adonis at the Rydale Festival. Ellie is a graduate or an alum of Genesis 16, a graduate from York University where she studied with Robert Honeyworth, yes. Sang in the 24. And so, Ellie, I'm just going to put you on the spot. So, Ellie, what are we going to talk about? I don't know. Here's what we're going to talk about. Ellie, here's what we're going to talk about. This is your second opera at Rydale?
Yes.
Yeah, and the two shows that we've done, Acis and Galatea,
yeah,
and Venus and Adonis by John Blow,
mm-hmm.
Two Baroque operas.
Yes.
What's your take on Baroque opera just from this experience?
I would say I've really, really enjoyed both of these shows. I think the thing that I'm learning to do more and more and that I've enjoyed exploring the most is just how much you can lean into text when, like, colouring your words using your voice, and also just how much you can treat your vocal lines as if you're speaking. So, like, having the boldness to really inflect each word as if you were talking makes it a much more effective performance. And that's really fun because it kind of seems counterintuitive. Often in singing lessons, you're taught to obviously really sing through each line and each word, which you still need to do, but being a bit braver with text and leaning into the natural inflection of words is really fun.
I like that about it being counterintuitive, because I've been on everyone for the last 2 weeks to speak more and sing less.
Yes.
Sing less, speak more. And it's so true, isn't it?
Yeah.
That actually, that's what gives a lot of it, is sort of natural inflection and flow, as you say. That's a hand dryer because we're sat alarmingly close to the toilets here. Did you know any of this music by John Blow before?
No, it was all totally new to me. I listened through to the whole kind of opera, start to finish, just before I started learning all the chorus parts, and it is awesome music. I'm surprised that I hadn't come across it before. Everyone else seemed to know it. But
It's very, very powerful stuff,
isn't it? It's amazing, especially the last movement. It's just awesome.
Yeah, in this performance today that we've just done, I was struck by just how in the moment the chorus were. I found it incredibly moving, actually, and that's a big journey to take, isn't it, in a relatively short space of time. So we only started rehearsing 2 weeks ago, and we didn't rehearse every day by any stretch. So there's been a lot to take on board. You had to dance in this show as well as sing and move around and be a shepherdess and a cupid. There's a lot to cope with, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think what this what doing Rydale Festival twice now has taught me is the importance of the nature of the relationships you have with your colleagues, because I now feel incredibly close to the other singers in this particular group, and it does mean that you can just be like, take those extra risks on stage and be that little bit more vulnerable in those really special moments, because you totally trust each other and you know that you'll, you know, have each other's back on stage and things. And it means that the performance itself can just go a little further and, you know, hopefully be more emotional to be involved in as a singer, but also for the audience as well.
And that's when it's real. Yeah. As soon as you've got that emotional connection, it reads to those of us who are watching it. Let's have a listen to that last chorus from Venus and Adonis.
Thank you.
That's the choir of Clare College, Cambridge, with the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment playing the final chorus of John Blow's Venus and Adonis with René Jacobs at the helm.
That, and you're on that, aren't you?
Mm. Yeah, this is, I mean, we're talking about, you know, seminal formative moments. I remember being in the sessions for that, which I know that historically weren't entirely happy. But I remember the guitarist, it must have been Dime Miller and a couple of others, improvising some on some ground in the Dido, which we recorded in the same sessions, and just thinking, I must have been about 20, and just thinking, I had no idea that, you know, Baroque music could be like this. Having sort of been brought up with jazz and that sort of improvisation, I hadn't realised that the tradition just goes way, way back.
Baroque and roll. It says choir at Clare College, but it doesn't sound like a full choir to me in that final chorus. I'm just wondering, because I'm sure I can hear John Bowen.
That's right. It was that model of, you know, soloists near the microphones and the choir far away. So that might be it.
I see. Isn't it interesting that we started the episode with you, Sammy, in New York talking to two established opera types and finished it in Malton near Old York, contributors talking about how one could give most of oneself and be most vulnerable and expressive when feeling most supported by colleagues.
Yeah, so I think we often forget this and at our peril that whenever we do anything creative, we're putting ourselves on the line in some way. And I think you know, it's always priceless to be enabled to do that in a safe way, I suppose.
I think being true to yourself, and I really loved what Robert said, what Sammy said. Both said wonderful things. About caring, you know, and then finding a way in the most imaginative, creative way you can in any moment. Back yourself if you care enough about it to find the way to get what you think is going to really work for people.
So that's it for that episode. My dog is scraping at the door, wanting a further walk. Tom, thanks for stepping in. Lovely to hear your insights. Sammy,
thanks,
not nice to hear yours, though. And
we'll
be back in 2 weeks learning about the music. Actually, at a very vulnerable moment, the entire program recorded immediately as we came off finishing that four choir Benevoli recording, which is coming out shortly. Thanks for listening. Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.